Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. This week, I'm joined from the BBC Tech Desk by Fiona Graham and Leo Kellyan. Hello, folks.
Hello.
And my special guest is Leo Mirani, tech reporter at the business magazine Quartz or QZ.com. Hi, Leo.
Hi, Rory.
We've got two Leos. I'm going to get very confused. So here's a flavour of what's coming up.
And the government are behind it. You're able to pay your tax in it now. And there's two or three places that you're able to use it on the Isle of Man.
A number of cameras cover the device. We use them to detect if something's been attached to it.
Stay with us for that later on. But first this week, a titanic battle. One of the world's most powerful American technology companies is in the crosshairs of European regulators, accused of abusing its dominant position in the market. Yes, we're talking about the company that gave the world a whole new verb to Google. And let me Google something using voice recognition. OK, Google, 4K TV 40 inch. See what happens? And up it comes. Yeah, instead of just a list of links, right at the top I am seeing shop for 4K TV 40-inch on Google. There's a little information box I can press, and that tells me that some of these companies here have paid Google to be in this special box. Now, it was this specific shopping service that caught the eye of the new European Competition Commissioner, Margarete Vestager, and she wasn't keen.
Today we have adopted a statement of objection to Google. It outlines our preliminary view that Google's favorable treatment of its comparison shopping service, you probably know it as Google Shopping, is an abuse of Google's dominant position in general search.
Now, that European investigation into Google's dates all the way back to 2010, and it started with a complaint from a tiny British specialised search company called Foundom. Its founder, Siobhan Raff, told us why she thinks Google's practices should matter to consumers.
In the short term, it means that consumers are not getting the best options and are often ending up paying more for their products or services as a result. In the medium to long term, these practices are suppressing or smothering at birth the next generation of innovative technology companies who should be providing the next wave of exciting, dynamic innovation on the web. And consumers are never going to get to see those exciting new innovations.
Now, Google wrote a long blog post full of charts defending its business practices, but it didn't want to say anything in front of a microphone. But James Waterworth from the CCIA, an industry body representing computer and telecoms firms, including Google, told me the search world was changing and it wasn't clear that the Californian firm was actually hampering innovation.
The way consumers are finding information or shopping offers is changing all the time and changing fast. People find information or products through mobile applications. They find it through voice search engines, which are becoming more and more popular.
You don't see the concern that has been expressed as being a real one.
Well, the Commission has said that there's more of a problem on shopping than on other areas, so it'll be very interesting to see the Commission's data as to why there is more of a problem there. We remain to be convinced that the competitors have been significantly harmed. Many are doing very well. And that is, of course, the test which shows whether the market is stagnant, which is what competition law is for. We will want new companies and existing ones to be investing, coming up with new products and services. And that seems to be happening. So if that's happening, then we need to be sure that there's a problem before we act.
That's James Waterworth. Now, Leo Mirani, our special guest from Quartz. The argument from Google and from its defender there is that, listen, Europe's got this wrong. The world's moved on. We're all searching in different ways. It is no longer quite so dominant. Does that hold water?
I have to admit I don't buy it. Google is a fantastic search engine. It commands 90% of the market in Europe because it is such a good search engine. And one of the things that makes it so useful is that we all trust it. We trust it to give us an unbiased list of the best results. When they stick a bunch of paid results on top with a little sponsored thing, it's not immediately clear to most people, I would argue.
I kind of agree. I've been showing that to people this week and they haven't realised that box is a Google shopping service.
And according to the European Commission, this is not Google's first attempt at a shopping service. The first one was the amusingly named Frugal. And according to the Commission, that did not benefit from any favourable treatment and therefore did poorly.
So what you're saying is that there is a case to answer, but it's going to take an awfully long time, isn't it? Google is going to put all of its lawyers at work on this, and it's got some very expensive lawyers, and it could be ages before anything happens. What might happen, though, in the long run?
In the long... Well, this body called iComp, which is sponsored by Microsoft and which is one of the complainants and a big rival, looked at the numbers which are publicly available, and since 2006, every time... The European Commission has released a statement of objections against any company. The company has had to pay for it in some form or the other, whether it's changed the way it does its business, pay a fine. The Commission has never lost a case in the past 10 years. So I would not like to predict what's going to happen, but past results may be an indicator of future results.
Well, that's interesting. The view from America seems to be quite relaxed about this, but the view from Europe that perhaps... the EU has got its sights on Google and will win in the end. Now, a quick look at some other big stories. Fiona Graham, there's a row in India which involves Mark Zuckerberg's plan to give the internet free to millions of people. Why? What's this about?
It's a group of Indian companies that have withdrawn from internet.org. This is the consortium that's led by Facebook that says it wants to get the two-thirds of the world that are not on the internet online. The companies say the services are a huge threat to net neutrality, so the idea that all services should be equally accessible. Internet.org does let you get online, but it only lets you use a hand-picked group of sites, one of which, of course, is Facebook. And I have to say the BBC as well.
Another is the BBC, I was going to say that.
We have not withdrawn, and we're not commenting on it this time, I believe.
When you say we, you mean the BBC as a whole. We'd comment till the cows came.
Absolutely.
We're not allowed to.
It's because of something called zero rating. So the telecoms companies basically agreed to cover the costs of the data that's going to the users. And of course, if you're not on internet.org, that means that your users will have to pay to access your sites. So a lot of people would argue it's uncompetitive. It's not the first time this has been criticised, but unsurprisingly, Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook founder, has defended it, saying some access is better than none and anyone is free to join.
Leah Mirani, have you got a take on this?
Facebook put out some numbers which I think show whether internet.org is really succeeding in its stated mission of connecting the unconnected. And some 500 million people have used internet.org. But of those, only 7 million people have used the internet for the first time. So I'm not entirely convinced of his argument either.
Fiona, one other quick story. Somebody has grabbed the Segway, that eccentric device, and run off with it. Who's that?
It's a Chinese startup called Ninebot. Basically, they've got the backing of Xiaomi, which is the third biggest telecom company in the world. To add insult to injury, really, Ninebot, Segway had tried to say that they were infringing their patents because they also produce a very, very similar vehicle. And they tried to get an import ban back in September in the US, and now they've bought them. So apparently they wanted the patents and they've said that they're going to continue to trade a Segway in the US and in Europe.
It's been a long and interesting journey for Segway, and now it's under Chinese control. This is Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. Still to come, the cash machine that knows who you are. Now to a very important birthday, the 50th anniversary of Moore's Law, which really tells the story of the technology revolution. Leo Kellyan is about to explain it, but first, crudely, it says processing power doubles every 18 months. I'm sure you'll correct me on that in a minute. To illustrate this, I asked via our BBC Tech Tent Twitter account, what was your first computer and what kind of processing power it had? Matt Morris said, my first computer was a Sinclair ZX81 with a wobbly 16K expansion pack. My Pebble watch is now more powerful. Wilbert Kran said he had an Atari 800 XL 1.7 megahertz in 1983, and he's just tweeted from a 2013 Mac that's 1,508 times faster. Very precise. Leo Kellyan, you're now going to give us a much simpler way of understanding Moore's Law.
Yes, all right. And I'm going to use the 2 years mark because that's what Gordon Moore, who invented it, came up with most recently. Originally said a year, then 18 months, then 2 years. So to try and help people understand this, because our brains can struggle to cope with how fast things increase when there's an exponential rate of growth, I've come up with a quick thought experiment involving you. Right. Imagine that you go to a hotel swimming pool, you swim the 22 metres of that pool and decide that every 2 years you're going to come back and you'll double the amount that you swam that time.
It's a bit optimistic. I'm a slow swimmer.
Well, after a decade of doing this, you'd be swimming 32 lengths, which is a fair amount. But because of this doubling effect, after 26 years, you'd already be up to 180 kilometres, which is the distance from Taiwan to mainland China. And by 50 years, you'd be travelling more than 738,000 kilometres, the equivalent of swimming to the moon and back. Map that onto processing power and you realise how fast things have improved. And what made Gordon Moore's law so powerful was that it gave his company Intel a target to hit, as its chip guru Mark Bohr explains.
Having Moore's law as a guide, or I think as some of us have said, as our guiding North Star, has really been helpful. And I think without the pace that has been set for us by Moore's law, I think we'd be many generations behind in terms of technology. Instead of having all the computing power that a cell phone or a smartphone has in your hand today, we'd still be using desktop computers from 10, 15 years ago.
So what happens next? Well, a best-selling book, The Second Machine Age, predicts how the tech revolution is going to play out. I asked its authors, two academics from MIT, first Andrew McAfee and then Eric Brynjolfsson, whether Moore's law would continue to shape the future.
It's not quite irrelevant whether that density of transistors per chip continues to increase at the same rate for the next 50 years. It would be great if it did, but our future and our progress with all things digital honestly does not depend on that very much. It depends a lot more on getting the tools out there to more people, on improving our approaches with software and algorithms.
Well, if that's the case, one of the things talking to Intel was they said having Moore's law gave them a target to hit and they'd spend more money year after year in order to get there. Do we need a new kind of law then for those algorithms and software so that we can measure our rate of success?
I think if that happens, it's going to be even more impressive than the original Moore's law was. But when we talk to our friends who are working at the cutting edge of software systems that do artificial intelligence, they say, look, this terrain is shifting so quickly that we don't even have a rough rule of thumb or a heuristic to use to see where we should be in 12 months. We keep getting surprised.
But I think that's a great idea. I think that it's been wonderful the way Moore's law has galvanized not just Intel but the whole industry around that constant doubling and redoubling. You know, it's strange to call it a law because there's no law of physics that says right. It has to improve that way. It's really been a collective decision to do that. I would love it if we could set similar goals, but I think the real constraints these days is not so much in either software or hardware. It's in our business models and it's our policies.
But Eric, we've seen in China, for instance, mm-hmm. lots of people go to the cities mm-hmm. working in the factory jobs. Mm-hmm. We're seeing the robots come into those factories. Right. Isn't there the potential for disruption when those jobs disappear?
Well, there's more than the potential. We're seeing a lot of disruption in China and lots of other countries. And that's because we're, in many cases, fumbling this opportunity. The tools that Moore's Law is delivering are tools. They don't shape our destiny by themselves. They give us the opportunity to change the world in different directions. One possibility is a world of broadly shared prosperity, and that's the one we need to work towards.
Eric Brynjolfsson from MIT there. Leo Moroni, our special guest, just briefly, what was your first computer and how much have you moved on since then?
My first computer was a Pentium 100, which made me the envy of all my friends who were still schlepping around with old 486 machines.
And have you worked out how many times more powerful your current computer is?
I haven't the foggiest, but I'm sure it's several hundred or thousand or million, who can say?
I did the sums myself for my first computer 20 years ago, and it's such a big sum that I can't quite compute it. We must move on. Now, there's growing competition amongst the world's islands to be the testing ground for the digital currency Bitcoin. The Isle of Man off the northwest coast of Britain is one contestant. Last month, it updated its anti-money laundering laws to bring Bitcoin into line with other currencies. Our reporter Zoe Kleinman is there, and I asked her, given the island's ambitions, how easy it was to get by on Bitcoin.
Well, Rory, I'm sitting on the seafront of the main town of Douglas, and it looks like a traditional British seaside resort, but it's got phenomenally fast internet speeds compared with UK standards. Perched on the clifftops to my left is the headquarters of a multi-billion dollar poker firm, and on the promenade there's another enormous gaming firm looming large on the horizon. So it sounds, doesn't it, like you might think all you need here is your digital wallet. But to be honest, Rory, I haven't found that many small, more everyday businesses that have embraced the whole cryptocurrency thing. But they are out there, including the island's only all-female taxi firm. Founder Nuala Perrin picked me up at the airport and I asked her how many customers ask to pay in Bitcoin.
We do about two or three a week.
In honesty, Nuala, is it a bit of a gimmick, do you think?
I think it's a bit of a gimmick, and it's obviously, as a new taxi company, it's something to get us noticed. However, I do feel that there's a very strong movement from the gaming, and the government are behind it. You're able to pay your tax in it now, and there's two or three places that you're able to use it on the Isle of Man. I feel there's a lot of names behind it and a lot of will behind it to make it happen. So in the next year, I think it will be good for us, yeah.
Zoe, Bitcoin often hits the headlines for all the wrong reasons. Can it escape its murky past?
Well, you're right. And just this week, we've had a report from the Internet Watch Foundation claiming that illegal images of children are being exchanged on the net in return for Bitcoin. However, I have to say, I found it difficult to get hold of the currency without providing a lot of formal ID and personal information. And the authorities here hope that regulation will act as a deterrent to criminal activity because the criminals will no longer be anonymous. But that said, it does also result in a lot more paperwork for the Bitcoin suppliers. Charlie Woolnough founded Isle of Man-based Bitcoin exchange Coin Corner here last year, and he also runs the Manx Digital Currency Association.
I don't think anyone really ever wants to be regulated. I mean, you know, with regulation comes cost and you know, there's a burden that comes with it. But anyone who expects this industry to remain unregulated really is living in cloud cuckoo land.
But the cybersecurity experts, they're really still urging caution, aren't they?
Well, Rory, it's worth bearing in mind that Bitcoin is still an incredibly volatile currency. I sat and watched it lose $12 in the space of about 20 minutes. Also, it's largely unprotected still, as Professor Alan Woodward, cybersecurity expert at Surrey University, explained.
It has this big downside in that the very reason that some people like it, the fact that it's not looked after by a central bank, means that you can't rely upon it. There is nobody propping it up as such. It's also true to say that one of the things that's happened recently in the United States, the Internal Revenue Service, have now said that they're going to treat Bitcoin as property. So there will be some regulation. It won't be regulated as a currency per se, but you will still end up paying taxes on it, etc. So some of the gloss, some of the shine is definitely going off it.
Professor Alan Woodward there, and thanks to Zoe Kleiman for that report from the Isle of Man. And now from the money of the future to what might seem like old technology, with cash under threat from electronic currencies. You might think the cash machine or ATM would have very little future. But NCR, the company which makes most of the world's ATMs, believes that a new model which is controlled from the cloud and can be used with mobile phones will prove very attractive, particularly in developing countries. I went to have a look. Well, I'm in front of a shiny new ATM with Andy Monaghan from NCR. Andy, it looks brand new, it looks quite modern, but is it that much different from the ATMs we've all got used to?
This ATM has a number of benefits which make it simpler for the consumer to use, including a touchscreen which has an encryption capability for entering your PIN. So it's very aligned to the tablets that you people are using today.
I gather one of the problems is that when Microsoft withdrew support for Windows XP, that left more than 90% of the world's ATMs still on Windows XP and therefore vulnerable.
Absolutely. So this machine's been moved to Android, moving as much of the functionality out of this device and into a cloud-based set of enterprise services.
Let's have a go then. I want to get some money out. Now, you can also use your mobile phone with this. I've got an Android phone and I've logged into my bank account. It says I need to scan to withdraw $20. There's the QR code. I'm scanning. Right. Withdrawing $20 from current account. So I've not actually put a card into the machine or anything. All I've done is a mobile transaction, which is ending up with money coming out of a cash machine. And there it comes. Now, the other question, of course, is we know about a lot of frauds done on the physical cash machines themselves. What is there about this that will stop any of that happening?
a number of cameras cover the device. We use them to detect if something's been attached to it. We also have a shutter on the cash dispenser, which will actually sweep across the card reader. Now, the purpose of that is to stop somebody sticking a skimming device to the front of this ATM.
Robert Johnston, you've done a lot of the work on the software side of this. Why would this be more attractive, potentially, for developing world operators?
Well, in the developing world, a lot of governments put legislation on the banks to say that they must provide a certain amount of or a certain number of cash machines out to rural locations or to deal with population centres where there's a large number of unbanked people. And in many cases, that can be difficult to do from a cost point of view because of the complexities of operating thick client ATMs at very remote locations with poor communications. Suddenly now we've taken all of that local input away from this because they can just put the machine out there, attach it to the network, and it works, as opposed to needing all that installation and maintenance on site.
That's Robert Johnston of NCR. I have to tell you that the first time we tried that process with the cash machine, the software locked up. We had to reboot. Always happens with technology demos. Leo Morani, we've heard there Bitcoin and a new ATM, sort of two sides of how far we're progressing in bringing technology into sort of into the money world. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
People have been predicting the end of cash for a very, very long time, Rory. And let's take the euro, for example. Since the time they launched the euro, the number of pieces of paper and coins floating around have doubled. So cash is not going anywhere. But what happens is all these new technologies, not necessarily Bitcoin, but say Apple Pay, for example, are aimed at small transactions. And the people using those are also young people, just like cash. So I think the two are sort of coexisting. People are using them depending on what's more convenient for them rather than one replacing the other one.
I'm certainly finding contactless are being a revolutionary way of buying a sandwich, so I'm not getting so much cash out of machines. But Fiona Graham, back to Bitcoin. Are you a believer in Bitcoin? Because we heard so much about it last year. It was very 2014 Bitcoin. Is it still 2015?
I think potentially, yes. We just did a month on FinTech and Tech of Biz, and we had quite a few pieces on Bitcoin in the UK and also in emerging market economies. There's a whole group of startups who are using money transfer technology and they're using Bitcoin to do it. Downfall, of course, is that it has to be transferred immediately because the big problem with Bitcoin at the moment and the thing I think that's going to stop widespread adoption is it's so volatile. It fluctuates so widely during a day. It can go up and down by $100, $150, which means using it as a currency in everyday use isn't without risk.
Yeah, and famously, I had some Bitcoin on a phone and wiped the phone and forgot that I'd left the Bitcoin on it, which by that time had appreciated tenfold from when I first got it, so a bit costly. Briefly, Leo Kellyan, are you a Bitcoin believer?
I think it's a fascinating experiment. I'm just not convinced that for the average consumer it's going to suit their lifestyle.
A good summary there. Yeah, the technology, the blockchain technology behind Bitcoin making a lot of waves, perhaps not the currency itself. Well, that is it for this week. We're out of time again. Thanks to my special guest, Leo Morani from Quartz, and to Fiona Graham and Leo Kellyan from the BBC Online Tech Desk. You can read all their work, including that stuff on Moore's Law, at bbc.com/technology. Thanks to you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week.